Have you heard about FDA-approved VYVGART? Efgartigimod alpha FCAB? Visit VYVGARTHCP.com to discover the mechanism of action, see the clinical trial data, and learn how to get your patients started on VYVGART. Explore how VYVGART may help your adult patients at VYVGARTHCP.com. VYVGART is a registered trademark of Argenx.
This is Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. The Neurology Podcast provides practical information to neurologists and other clinicians to help them provide better care for their patients. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Mincer. I'm an epileptologist at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, and I'm here with the latest edition of the Neurology Podcast. Today, we are going to discuss a very interesting recent publication in the journal. It's titled Factors Predicting Outcome After Intracranial EEG Evaluation in Patients with Medically Refractory Epilepsy. And I am very pleased to have the first author of the paper, Aditya Sivaraju from Yale University, here with me today. Aditya, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Scott, and thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
We're going to start off by, if you could, giving us a succinct summary of what you studied for this paper and what your main findings are.
Cohort that we looked at in this study was essentially patients spread out over a 10-year period. And these were patients with medically refractory epilepsy, which by definition is these are the patients that have failed at least two medications or more, and they continue to have seizures. But then we as a group decide that we need more localizing information before we can offer them any kind of surgical intervention. And to obtain that data, we perform intracranial electrode evaluation. So all these patients had both medically refractory epilepsy and also required intracranial EEG. We know from decades of data that surgical resection offers the best chance for seizure freedom. And this was essentially the focal point of our study. So the study was designed around this with two goals in mind. The first was to identify the predictors of a resective surgery, and the second was to identify those factors that can predict sustained seizure freedom following an intracranial EEG evaluation. What we found was that the probability of undergoing a resective surgery was higher if the patients had the intracranial electrodes implanted on the non-dominant hemisphere, or if they had a lesional MRI, meaning they had some kind of clear abnormality on the MRI imaging, or all the pre-surgical information suggested that the seizures were going to come from the temporal lobe. But when it comes to seizure freedom, though, two factors really stood out. The first one was having a very clear focal onset on the intracranial EEG. And the second one was that the patients, if they undergo resective surgery following an intracranial implant, they were more likely to have sustained seizure freedom at five-year follow-up. And this was true even when we compare the patients that undergo resection with those that had just continued medical treatment or they had neuromodulation. The chance of seizure freedom was lower, but it was still much higher than any neuromodulation procedure, even for those patients with traditionally unfavorable predictors, such as those with extratemporal neocortical epilepsies and non-lesional cases.
So basically, you found a number of factors that were associated with being more likely to get a resection and more likely to become seizure-free. But even in the patients who lacked all of those features, the patients who were in the lousy prognostic group still were a lot more likely to become seizure-free if they got a resection than if they went on continued medical therapy. Is that a fair summary of what you found?
Yes, absolutely, Scott.
Obviously, you folks are not the first people to study factors that lead to good outcome in intracranial EEG. Can you tell us what specifically your paper adds to the literature on the subject?
There have been several studies that have reported that surgical resection without functional impairment really offers the best chance for seizure freedom. The interesting thing about this literature is most of this existing literature suggests that nearly a quarter of the patients who enter an intracranial EEG program do not undergo resective surgery. So that's a significant number of patients who have electrodes implanted, but they don't undergo a resective surgery post-implant. But despite this, most of the outcome studies published to date, they exclude details about all the patients entering a program. And the reason why I think this is significant is when I see a patient, the first question that pops up is, what is my chance of seizure freedom? And when I try to answer that question, I like to first think about what are the chances that this patient can actually undergo resection first. And then I look at the seizure freedom. So what we did with this study was not just focus on the outcome data of only patients undergoing resection, but we wanted to sort of take a step back and really look at all the patients undergoing intracranial EEG or entering the program. So we compared the data across three groups, which is all the patients undergoing intracranial EEG or implantation, those that underwent resection, and the remaining patients, which included the continued medical treatment and neuromodulation. I strongly think that having the data and taking a step back and looking at not just the patients who undergo resection, but everybody coming into the program really improves our ability to counsel the patients entering a surgical program. And in addition to all of this, our data again suggests that unfavorable predictors should not deter a thorough pre-surgical evaluation, including invasive intracranial EEG recording in many cases.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize the fact that on the one hand, when we do intracranial EEG studies, obviously it's a big deal. It's a lot to put a patient through, and we want to be able to do a resection in every patient if there are as many patients as possible. On the other hand, I also feel like, you know, as an aggressive surgical epileptologist myself, if you don't have a fair number of patients who can't get a resection, then you probably weren't doing enough intracranial EEG studies. You know, it's almost like what they say to about the appendectomy and the general surgeons. You know, if a certain percentage of them aren't normal, then you're not doing enough of them. And I feel like since you can't tell exactly what data you're going to get until you do the study, you have to have a number of patients where you're not going to get a resection at the end, or else you're not being aggressive enough about doing them.
And that's the only way that even we understand and offer the best chance for the patient to really have their best shot at seizure freedom.
For the general practicing neurologists who are listening to this podcast, what do you think are the major take-home points for those folks?
There's decades of data that clearly shows that epilepsy surgery is heavily underutilized. And I strongly believe, along with many of my colleagues, that any patient who failed two or more seizure medications should be referred to an epilepsy surgical center. Now, there have been very nice papers published that are called as epilepsy nomograms, which are essentially standardized scales where you can plug in a few numbers that spits out what is your chance of seizure freedom. And these scales can be very helpful for practicing neurologists, but if they identify a high chance of seizure freedom, because the concern is that, so for example, you have a standardized scale which has a few variables that you can plug in, like does a patient have a lesion on the MRI? Does a patient have generalized seizures? And you plug in these values and it gives you a certain percentage of having seizure freedom. So if this number is high, then it's quite likely that they might say, okay, great, let's send this patient to an epilepsy surgical center. But if these scales point to a low probability, it is possible that they may not be referred to a center. So the likelihood of whether they can undergo surgery or whether the outcome is good or not, or neuromodulation, et cetera, I don't think it should be a discussion point at this level. Any medically refractory patients, meaning those that have failed two or more medications, should just first get their foot in an epilepsy surgical center. It is crucial to know that thorough individualized evaluation for epilepsy surgery and other aspects of epilepsy care is really important for superior outcomes and lower death rates, including, as we are all concerned about, is SUDEP or sudden unexplained death in epilepsy.
Nomograms are nice, but don't let them be the thing that you use to decide whether to refer people or not. Refer essentially everybody who has failed a few seizure medications.
Yeah, I would say so.
I would personally interject that I heartily agree with you and that this is an issue that the field of epilepsy has been struggling with for decades now. The reasons why people don't refer patients to epilepsy centers remain somewhat obscure. So I hope this paper can contribute to help convincing people that they should refer first and think about the details later. the scale of intracranial EEG patients, it's quite a large study and is done over patients over a long period of time. Despite the fact that it is a good-sized study, the issue that always comes up with single center studies is how generalizable are the findings. In some sense, somebody could say, well, you've demonstrated that outcomes are good for surgical therapy and better for any other kind of therapy if for patients who are going to Yale. Do you think this does or does not apply to other centers? How generalizable are these findings?
It's a significant limitation. I mean, there's no way around it in terms of generalizability. And there are two aspects to this, I think. And like you rightly pointed it out, in the scheme of intracranial studies, it's a largish sample size. And the results of any single center study need to be interpreted with a grain of salt. More so, I think our institutional approach to designing an intracranial EEG has almost always involved a combination of depth electrode, strips, and grid as needed, while the current trend at most centers is primarily towards stereo EEG or sEEG, which utilizes multiple depth electrodes. I mean, it is possible that our approach may be the reason for the kind of approach that we have, may be the reason for better outcomes, but this is very hard to compare across centers due to variability in the surgical approach from center to center and the patient heterogeneity. However, I think it's important to note that there have been a few studies that came out recently emphasizing sort of the same take-home point that even with centers utilizing primarily stereo EEG, that surgical resection needs to be considered first before anything else. So our study approach may not be generalizable, but I think the findings do have a shared impact across centers.
So Aditi, one last thing I'd like to ask you. My thought on reading this as a surgical epileptologist was, you know, I was so struck by the fact that even the patients with the poor prognostic factors, the ones who, you know, had extratemporal foci, the ones who were in the dominant hemisphere, even these folks who got resections had seizure-free rates in the, you know, 35-40% range, which obviously we would like it to be a lot higher, but it was still, you know, markedly higher than the patients in those groups who had to get medical management or neuromodulation, who only had seizure-free rates of 6 or 7%. And the thing it made me think of, you know, from my perspective is, you know, should we be, you know, even more aggressive about doing resections in intracranial EEG patients? What did you think about that issue as you looked at your own data and analyzed this?
Over the past decade, you know, we have witnessed a paradigm shift in the field of epilepsy surgery with the availability of responsive neurostimulation or RNS and deep brain stimulation or DBS, which are great therapeutic alternatives for the patients who cannot undergo resection. But the concern here is that it's a bit of a slippery slope that, and we often discuss this in our conferences and across, you know, with my colleagues at other centers, is that, again, if there is a patient that is deemed to have a low chance of seizure freedom, that they would end up straight going to neuromodulation, that thereby negating the possibility of a resective surgery. By extension, lowering the chance of seizure freedom, because like you just said, even in those patients with traditionally unfavorable predictors, they still have a 35 to 40% chance of 5-year seizure freedom, which is certainly not the case with neuromodulation approaches. They do benefit from significant seizure reduction, but not necessarily sustained freedom. At the end of the day, ultimately, the decision to proceed with an intracranial implant needs to be individualized. Like you had mentioned in the beginning of the recording, it's a big deal. And patient preference and their overall social situations are intangibles that play an important role in the overall discussion leading up to an intracranial implant. But yes, the possibility of a resective surgery without functional impairment should always be considered first. And we are also, as we understand more, and we are now starting to utilize them in combination. You can resect what you can without the functional impairment, and you modulate the areas that you cannot resect. A combination of the responsive neurostimulation and resection has also been done in many of these cases at our center and at many other centers.
It seems that whenever you can do a resection within the limits of functional compromise, as you said, and as you eloquently put it in the paper, you're going to give the patient a much better chance than they would with, you know, neuromodulation or with medical therapy.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
Great. Thank you very much, Aditya, for that elaboration and discussion on your excellent paper. And hope everybody enjoyed this neurology podcast and tune in for the next one.
This is Stacey Clardy, your podcast editor. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please take a few moments to subscribe, rate, and review the Neurology Podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And remember, you can always head to neurology.org/podcast for our full list of past episodes, or you can also search by keyword in your podcast app for any neurology-specific topics you want to learn about. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.